Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Neil Garfield Show, a presentation sponsored by www.livinglies.wordpress.com, GTC Honored, and the law firm of Garfield, Kelly & White, serving all 50 states with news and analysis of the latest bank scams against borrowers, homeowners, consumers, and investors, and providing legal representation throughout Florida. This program is for general information only. It is not a solicitation for services or legal representation and should never be used as a substitute for advice from a licensed professional. And now, here's world-renowned financial expert, attorney, and blogger, Neil Garfield.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Neil Garfield Show. This is Jim Macklin sitting in again for Neil Garfield. Just a quick personal message out to Neil. Listen, Neil, you lay still and play nice tomorrow for the doctors. They are not mortgage bankers, and they mean you no harm. Today we have a really good show. I brought back Dan Edstrom for some follow-up on last week's show. Apparently, we got quite a lot of positive feedback from last week's show, and we felt like we could tie up some loose ends. We ended rather quickly last week. And also on today's show is California attorney Charles Marshall. Charles has been involved in multiple phases of wrongful foreclosure, unlawful, and related contract litigation in the state of California. He's got a lot of experience of being in court and hearing and watching, seeing how judges react and respond to a variety of pleadings, defenses, and as well items offered up by the opposition. So Charles' practical experience is going to be showcased a little bit. Charles' practice does take him from the deepest southern part of California, from San Diego all the way up north to Redding, and really all points in between. I'm going to get to both of our guests in just a few minutes, but first I wanted to tell the listening audience about an ad brief that was brought to my attention literally this morning by a listener and an active proponent in this area. Her name is Lilia Walsh, and she's a contributing member of a web group in California called Fight for Mortgage and Credit. This group is headed by a very knowledgeable woman named Monica Graham, and Monica and I have known one another for many years, and she has contributed greatly in California to a number of homeowners' positions, and we really appreciate the input from both Monica and Lilia. The brief that I'm referring to was authored by a from New York, and this brief is a blistering scenario of what happened at Wall Street. The brief was entered in as what's called an amicus curiae, and what that means to the listeners is that means that they're a friend of the court. And this was brought in a case called Arabobo. And this Arabobo case was a significant landmark case in the state of New York, wherein it was determined that the borrower was, in fact, deemed a third-party beneficiary to the pooling and servicing agreement. And naturally, the boys up on Wall Street, in their infinite wisdom, decided to take this up on appeal. And Bob entered in an amicus brief that I read actually twice today. It's rather voluminous, but the brief outlined a number of federal cases, including some Supreme Court decisions, that that were significant and are directly on point. I'm going to go to parts of the brief right now that I took apart and decided to save because it was so good. Bob talks about the controlling legal authority that's established or that purports to establish that mortgagors are, in fact, third-party beneficiaries of pooling and servicing agreements. And he cited to the restatement of contract second, as well as some New York and some federal case law. And he went on to describe a case called September Tide Publishing v. Stein and Day, which is an F-sub case from 1989 that held that in addition to the agreement itself, the court would look to surrounding circumstances in making its determination as to third-party beneficiaries and their need or their not needing to be named in the agreement at issue. So that case says that third-party beneficiaries to a contract don't necessarily need to be named in the agreement. And then he goes on to quote Blessing v. Freestone, which is a U.S. Supreme Court case from 97, where the Supreme Court gave a very simple analogy of a third-party beneficiary. And in the court's language, it states that in contract law, when Party A promises to pay Party B money, in exchange for which Party B promises to provide services to a third party, the person who receives the benefit of the exchange of promises between the first two parties is called a third-party beneficiary. And I felt like this was significant to today's discussion because if you listened last week, we specifically talked about third-party beneficiaries to contract, and we talked about a number of different criteria related to the step transaction doctrine, wherein we're correlating the parties that are all in a basically in a straight line. And it's part of what I want to talk to Dan Edstrom about first to kind of retouch on last week and dovetail these concepts in together. So, Dan, first of all, welcome to the show. How are you?
Great. Welcome.
Thank you. Appreciate it. I'm already here, though. I wanted to ask you why, in your opinion, notwithstanding what I just said, why the borrower is, in fact, a third-party beneficiary to the PSA, even though named as a third party within the PSA instrument. Go ahead.
Well, I would say that they are named indirectly, the same as the investors are named. But basically, the intent of the agreement was to use the homeowner's property credit, personal identifying information, their financial information to sell securities to investors, and in return for that, the use of the proceeds from the sale of securities to investors to fund the homeowner's loan, among other things. And besides that, the intent was to capture multiple payment streams, ensuring that the investors were paid and other obligations were met.
So, and that's let me pause at the question. Is there language contained within the pooling and servicing agreement that talks about the intent and purpose of the sales of securities?
The intent and purpose of the sale of securities?
Right. In other words, is there anything in the pooling and servicing agreement that identifies the intent of the trust, let's just say as the generalization?
I can't remember offhand. I know there's language in there.
Yeah, when we talked about this a couple weeks ago, we talked about the intent of the parties of the trust was that they were going to use the proceeds from the sale of mortgage-backed securities to essentially fund the mortgage loans.
Sure, to fund the mortgage loans and to pay for credit enhancements, such as third-party payments that will cover it, like certificate guarantee insurance and credit default swaps and other things.
And so in the simplest of terms, moving back to the Supreme Court analogy of A to B to C, if A were the certificate holders who purchased the securities and B were, say, the loan servicer or even the depositor, you could really simplify this and say the depositor, when the money came into, let's call it a super fund, the intent of that fund was to fund mortgages and to pay for ancillary credit enhancements. And then the C in the equation would be the borrower, upon which the entire transaction relied, because the borrower would have never gotten a loan if the securities hadn't been purchased by in any given particular instance. Does that
follow with what you're thinking? The most basic thing is that the benefit to the borrower at the very beginning was money to fund the loan transaction.
Right. That's right. So the perceived benefit, not the perceived, but the actual benefit is axiomatic. It really isn't automatic. Dan, have you been having a look at Section 580D of the California Code of Civil Procedure? I know that you emailed me about this, and I want to know what you find significant about this particular area of the Code of Civil Procedure as it relates to what's called an estoppel and how it may relate to these transactions.
Sure. 580D is the anti-deficiency statute, and basically it says that, you know, once the creditor forecloses on the security, that they can't go after the obligation to recover a money judgment. And then there was a case that was given where the court determined that the estoppel applies because once they've made their election of remedy to go after the security, they can't then go after the money.
Right. That was the Union Bank Gradsky case, which is a California appellate case, and it goes all the way back to 1968. And essentially, I think that what you were offering up in not even a theory, but how this case applies is, under the note, there are terms and conditions for what's called a guarantor. And, of course, this relates back to the Article 9 discussion that we had last week. The note itself specifically talks about parties that are obligated under the note, and that would be anybody that signs the note, and anybody who acts as a guarantee or a surety.
Under 580D, the anti-deficiency statute, what the court said was that it works as an estoppel to the creditor and to the guarantor. Neither of them can come after the homeowner. And then from there we make the leap over to the California Code of Civil Procedure, which is 726, I believe, which is the one action rule and the security first rule. And there's another case, right? There's another case out of California where a homeowner failed to make a payment, and they had a bank account at the bank where they had their mortgage loan from, and they were late, and so the bank went in and took money out of their account. I don't remember how much it was, maybe $10,000 on a $1 million loan. Well, under the one action rule and the security first rule, they didn't go after the lien. They went after the money to recover money. And
meaning that the estoppel would apply. Right.
Right, meaning that they waive the lien. The security first rule means that you go after the security first. If they don't, then you can use the rule as a defense or as a sanction. The rule that basically they waive the lien by going after the money. So the connection to this with securitization is that we have multiple obligors under the loan, namely the servicer and the trustee, who are obligated to make payments, and they typically do. In all the cases I've seen, they do make the payments. However, they fail to credit the homeowner for those payments. So my question basically to Neil was, would that constitute an election of remedies? And they
right.
basically
and
seeking
that
the money first before the lien.
Right, and that's a subject that we are going to have a forum with some experts next week, and perhaps Neil can bring that to the next show and talk about the results of the analysis, because we are going to go into a very deep analysis about what that means. But to put it, again, for the listeners in simple terms, if a party is making a payment and that payment is being accepted and received and applied to the account, the beneficiary to the account is precluded from accepting multiple payments. You can only take payment on a commercial credit account once. And so the party that made the payment secretly without telling the borrower that they made the payment now has painted itself into what we believe is a very difficult corner, because they are acting as an alleged agent of that principal, and they're claiming that the principal executed a notice of default or a declaration of default, and they execute these notices of default with regularity throughout the state of California, throughout the U.S. and all non-judicial states. And we believe that that premise may not hold true. And, in fact, based on, again, the research that's been done, it doesn't appear that it holds true. So moving from there, thank you, Dan. I'll get back to you in a minute on something. I want to introduce Charles Marshall. Again, Charles Marshall is a practicing attorney in California. We have done work together, and Charles has gotten his sleeves rolled up and his fingers dirty in this. Charles, first of all, hi, how are you, and thanks for coming.
Yes. Hi, Jim. It's great to be here on the show today.
Good. Charles, after what you just heard, and we talked a little bit briefly before the show about this, one of the first questions that I think the listeners might want to hear is an attorney's perception of the state of litigation within the foreclosure arena, specifically in California. How do you feel like things are going right now in court?
I think they're both trends and counter-trends. Lasky was somewhat the high watermark in August when the appeal came through of last year. And since then, there's been some pushback, particularly at the federal level within California. Specifically, the Eastern District is looking at Lasky less favorable, which isn't to say that it's completely discarded or disregarded. That's certainly not the case. I mean, as a framework for a lawsuit, centering the lawsuit around issues of broken assignments and failure to meet certain timelines and guidelines related to the pooling and servicing agreement where you have securitization. But whether you have securitization or not, if there's a problem with the assignments as to timing, as to fraud because they're backdated, as to robo-signing where you can show that essentially, you know, a la the federal rules of evidence, which have corollary rules in California, and basically mean that when documents are drawn up and they're vetted thereafter, those reviewing the documents have to be personally attesting to their veracity. And of course, if you're robo-signing, you may be going through 1,000 documents in one day. You certainly can't be attesting personally to their contents. So at the end of the day, at the end of the day, the standing arguments, well, they were temporarily sort of stood on their head because of the Glaske appeal, where normally the borrowers are on the defensive, and they're being kicked out of court under the premise that they don't have standing. Glaske reversed that in the sense that it was the lenders, it was the servicers, it was those on the other side of the California plaintiff's lawsuits where the borrowers are the plaintiff. And in those cases, you know, a la Glaske, all of a sudden it was the servicer and lender who was said not to have standing where the assignments were broken or inadequate, because then the enforcement of those assignments becomes void. You have the whole distinction between void and voidable. Glaske essentially hammered that point home very, very firmly and straightforwardly. That's one of the reasons it went through. But there are some counter trends, and, you know, when you're in court on some cases, at times, you know, whether it's, let's say, Contra Costa County or even the Northern District, especially if you're not in San Francisco in the Northern District, there are a number of courts where it's almost like you're in 2010 again, where the judge is talking about the tender rule, the judge is talking about lack of standing, still using the analysis to say that the borrower is not a party to the original pooling and servicing agreement. And by the way, one has to keep in mind that these agreements are promulgated, in many cases were promulgated during the heyday of the foreclosure rush, you know, 2005 to 2007. These agreements would often involve the loan being put into the pooling and servicing agreement literally within days of origination. And
well,
one of the
let me jump in for a second, Jim. The interesting part about what you just said is a perception that I think that people mistake in that the loans based on the chain of what actually occurred, these loans were pre-sold. When the borrower went to the closing table, the closing table people have already been in contact with four or five different, let's call them trusts, representatives, who were offering money that had already the investors who bought certificates had already paid for them. So they were effectively pre-sold. If they got lumped into a given category, and we don't know, although there are underlying agreements between these mortgage brokers and these warehouse lenders where the warehouse lenders entered into a $50 million brokerage agreement and said, okay, here's $50 million, go get them. And so
precisely,
the loans were effective.
This is why this...
Yeah, go ahead.
Sure, go ahead.
This
is why the step transaction doctrine so clearly applies here, because these loans were predicated on being sold off into a pooling and servicing agreement from the very beginning. And like you said, the arrangements were set up so that essentially the borrower's performance was not at all necessary. That's why so many loans were done. That's why so many loans were done with borrowers who literally couldn't afford, and you had situations where you had low documentation, no documentation, absurd stated income type situations where there was literally no documentation of employment at all. All these things transpired for precisely the reasons you're mentioning, Jim, because basically everybody was getting paid at the end of the day. There was a strong position of insurance covering every part of the business transaction. And it's that transaction doctrine is meant to get to that.
Right. Let me jump back for a quick second because this is I'm personally involved in this. It might warrant an attorney looking at a pleading in the alternative under the federal rules at Rule 8. You can plead in the alternative, and if, in fact, you find that you have a low-doc, no-doc loan that was consummated by one of these now defunct organizations, if, in fact, the borrower never qualified for the loan to begin with, that contract could be deemed as void. And California has a very specific law that relates to the void nature of a contract where the use of false information can be the grounds for a false instrument. And if that instrument is false, it's void. It never existed. And then you might have to plead in the alternative and go into breach of contract for other reasons that we can look at. Let me ask you another question, Charles.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
In a simple term, what do you think the biggest hurdle is for people that are facing foreclosure? And what can they do to protect themselves?
Well, the biggest hurdle is dealing with the uncertain legal environment. And in California, I would say the legal environment is still a difficult one. On the other hand, you know, the analogy I use with clients all the time, and I think this is applicable in a lot of non-judicial foreclosure states, you know, not to spend more than a little bit of time on this, but, you know, judicial foreclosure states, there is some vetting over a period of months of the entire process. And of course, in non-judicial foreclosure states, that's all short-circuited under the theory that this is a more expeditious way of settling the disputes over the property more efficiently. You know, it preserves resources. But in reality, particularly in California, it really deprives the borrowers when they're said to be going into default. And, of course, that's one of the critical components to the cases I handle. And it's something that Jim and I have talked about a number of times. It's critical never to admit the default. And you want to avoid admitting the default in any proceeding, whether it's a motion for relief from stay in bankruptcy, whether it's even an unlawful detainer after the property has already gone back to the lender or gone to a third party at the initial stages of litigation. The biggest difference for borrowers in terms of, you know, what's happening on the ground in California is, unlike, let's say, personal injury, where you can just hire any attorney down the street, and the law is so settled, you'll practically know your settlement amount when you show up at his office or her office. It makes a huge difference who you use as an attorney in California, because the litigation climate is difficult, because you're going to get a lot of pushback from the lenders and servicers, because you have to have your attorney craft and then present compelling pleadings, developed pleadings, for you to have a good shot at getting a settlement. But if you do hire an attorney with strong intention who puts a lot of details into their pleadings and understands the various legal postures that exist in all the different districts and counties, then you've got a good shot at getting a really good settlement. And one of the things I like about Jim, one of the things I like about your approach, Jim, is that you want to get down to the most foundational elements of the contract, whether it's involving a PSA, other assignments, whoever the players are, and then go to the heart of the legal framework to then break down that legal framework so you can go into court and get judges to see that, look, at the very foundation, there are violations here that mean that essentially the instruments are void. And that's, you know, that's the gold star, where you can get a declaration that the instruments are void, a la Glaske. Then that's when you can really get the hard settlement, because we all know in California none of these cases virtually ever go to trial. And the reason for that is no servicer, no lender to be, you know, taken before a jury on these issues, and they absolutely do not want the precedential authority that would devolve from such a hearing when it went against them. So they will settle. You have to push, and it helps to push early. It helps to get into discovery early so that you can put the lender or servicer on the defensive. You're not necessarily going to get really good results from the discovery, but you need to push for that in order to get your case going well.
Right, and just about a minute left before we have to sign off, so thank you for that. That is great stuff. And I brought Charles on to the show today. Neil and I have a long history together, and Neil likes to talk to attorneys that roll their sleeves up, get their fingers dirty, and get in there and get results. Charles Marshall's office has been very prolific in achieving results. That's the bottom line, is some form of settlement, and that settlement has to be amenable to the borrower. Charles, real quickly, please give me the phone number. If anybody wants to get a hold of you from California, please shoot us out the phone number right now.
Yeah, absolutely. It's 619-807-2628.
Great. So, and if anybody has a question for Jim at Secure Document Research, you can contact me at 530-888-9600. I can certainly help in directing. Dan, about 10 seconds. Please give a number or any final 10-second comment.
916-207-6706.
That was bold. That was a cell phone number, folks. Thanks for listening, and we hope you'll tune in again next week. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to our broadcast. We hope that you tell your friends about us and let them know that there is hope and help in this financial crisis. Tune in every week to The Neil Garfield Show for free information and advice, and visit our blog daily at The Living Lies Blog. We provide support services, the latest strategies, analysis, expert consultations, testimony, and declarations to use in your battle against the largest economic crime in human history. For information concerning Neil, the team at Living Lies, or the law firm, go to www.livinglies.wordpress.com or call 520-405-1688. The opinions expressed on this broadcast are those of the host and should not be attributed to any other person or entity.